Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Okay, hello everybody. Welcome back to New Books in Sports, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Paul Knepper, and today I'm excited to welcome Don Stradley to the show. He's here to talk about his book, The War, Hagler, Hearns, and Three Rounds for the Ages. Don, welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I wonder if you could start off by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself.
Well, I've been writing for The Ring magazine for quite a few years, and also most of the boxing magazines I've been in, including some of the British magazines, and also a digital magazine called Ringside Seat, which you should all check out if you like good writing and whatnot, good photographs. Ringside Seat has been around for a couple of years, and we're still building a little audience. I think it's good. And when I'm not writing about boxing, I write about movies. I work for a couple of movie streaming platforms, Fandor and The Film Detective. You like movies? Fandor is the place to go. We're sort of a junior Netflix type of thing. And I have a bunch of books out that you can find on Amazon. I've written a book about Edwin Valero, a book about Carlos Monzon, and my new one about Hagler and Hearns.
So let's jump into that. As you document so well in the book, Hagler Hearns is considered by many to be the greatest fight of all time. Some people will qualify and say the greatest short fight of all time, however you want to call it, it's always in that discussion for the greatest fights of all time. What made it such a great fight?
Well, a few factors. The main one being that there was so much publicity around it that everyone's eyes were on it. You know, it was a big, big event. And it lived up to the publicity. How many fights really live up to the publicity? Not many. And this fight received more publicity than most. So I think that was something that really affected people in 1985. This huge amount of publicity, and then it turned out to be a great fight. So it was as if it elevated boxing a little bit, you know, because boxing at the time was struggling. A lot of the older fighters were either going into retirement or they just didn't look as good as they had a couple of years earlier. They were Larry Holmes and Jerry Cooney, Ray Mancini. The big names were starting to fray a little bit. And Hagler and Hearns, they were not as big as those other fighters, but they were really the last two guys available. So Bob Arum decided we'll put them together, and he had tried in the past and it didn't work out. He said, we'll put them together and we will hype this fight. And it was an unbelievable amount of publicity that went into it. Modern fans couldn't even imagine it because now you can just have a press conference. You can, you know, have it on social media. You can reach a lot of people pretty easily now. just in one afternoon. But back then, Aram put both fighters on private jets and had them flying around the country, going from one city to another. He did this for weeks. So every morning you'd pick up your newspaper and you'd read about the fight. You know, where were they today? Well, they're in Texas or they're in Los Angeles. And they would argue with each other and call each other names. And some of it was silly, but some of it got heated. And just because there was so much hype, that really attracted people to it. And then it was such an explosive fight that, you know, it got into the public's mind. People talked about it for months and months and months. We're still talking about it all these years later. You know, I mean, Tyson Fury and Wilder just had their great fight a few nights ago or last week. Are we still going to be talking about that fight 40 years from now? I don't know. It's a strange thing to think about. But yeah, Hagler-Hearns, people still talk about it.
As I said before we came on, you know, before we started recording, I was pretty young then. But one thing that really surprised me in reading the book was, you know, from what I do remember as a kid and looking back, and I think now we look back on that age in boxing and particularly around that weight class, and we look at it as kind of a glory days, you know, with Hearns and Hagler and Duran and Leonard. So I was very surprised to read that there was a lot of concern as to whether the Hagler Hearns would sell. And that is, as you mentioned, they had kind of tried to put it together once. Hagler in particular, because, you know, from what I know, many people consider him one of the great middleweights of all time. I was very surprised that he in and of himself was not a draw. He kind of needed that other big personality or big name to go with him. Why was Hagler not a bigger draw in and of himself?
Well, Hagler had a few things working against him. One was that he when he was young, he came up at a time where the only attention being paid was to Muhammad Ali. Everyone else in boxing was in the back seat. You know, that was just how it was. Then Ray Leonard stepped into that spotlight and everyone had to take a back seat to Ray Leonard. And that's how boxing has always been historically. You have one figurehead and everyone else is just trying to get a little piece of the spotlight. Whether it was Jack Dempsey or Joe Louis or Ray Robinson or whoever, there was always one main attraction. Everyone else was in the back seat. That's just how it has been. Mm-hmm. So Hagler had that. The other problem was he was from Massachusetts and boxing was dying in Massachusetts. It had been pretty big in Boston way before Hagler. But once Hagler turned pro, boxing in this area was not that big. So he had problems getting attention even on a local level. And I point out in the book, it's hard to imagine. Promoters would try to put Hagler in the Boston Garden. He'd have trouble selling 5,000 seats. And seats were only $10. Okay. So those are the two main issues, just the timing and his location. And a third issue was his personality just did not get over. He didn't know how to project himself. From the people I have spoken to, because I knew his trainers pretty well. I never got to know Marvin, but I knew his brother a little bit, Robbie, and I knew his trainers a little bit. From what I've heard, he was a very nice guy, but he couldn't project that. He didn't know how to project that. If there were too many people around, he would get a little bit cranky. He liked his privacy. So he just didn't really know how to play that game. He eventually got better at it, you know, but when he was young and coming up at the time when you're supposed to be grabbing all of that attention, he just didn't know how to do it. It did not come naturally to him. Not all boxers have that gift of gab, you know, They don't all have that natural charisma. So he was sort of a cult figure, what he was. The real hardcore boxing fans knew about him and appreciated him. But the mainstream just, they were not that impressed with him. It took him a long time to cross over and get the attention. In fact, he was, at one point, he was the highest paid athlete in the world and was still not very popular. You know, it was because Bob Arum was gambling on him and giving him a lot of money to keep him under the top rank promotional umbrella. So he was just paying Hagler a lot of money, but Hagler was really not that popular yet. So he was rich before he was famous.
Right. And how did Hearns's personality compare to Hagler?
Well, one thing that I turned up in the book that I sort of knew, but learned more about it, was that a lot of the coverage Hearns got early on was that he was this sort of eccentric character, kind of a offbeat kind of guy who, you know, collected the kind of guy, rare animals.
The good kind of guy who was a pet cougar who attacks him, right?
Yeah. He had rare animals. They would attack him occasionally. He wanted to be a cop in Detroit. He had all of these, not hobbies, but he had a lot of quirks. And a lot of the press, they would write about him as if he was this kind of, he liked hanging out with Michael Jackson. And I think when Hearns was hanging out with Michael Jackson, he thought, this is how a famous person is supposed to act. Because Michael Jackson had the weird pets. He kind of isolated himself. Hearns started wearing his hair like Michael Jackson for a while. Though a lot of guys did at that point. It wasn't just Tommy. So I always wondered if Tommy kind of thought, this is how I have to behave now that I'm famous, you know? And he did what a lot of guys do when they make a couple million bucks. You know, he turned his house into this kind of playground where he had his own DJ set up, you know, and it was very extravagant. But in the end, if you see Tommy now, he's a very basic kind of guy. He's not flashy at all. But I think when he was young, he thought, that's what I have to do. But he was an interesting character, and the press never quite got on the Tommy Hearns bandwagon. All of those guys have been mythologized since then as these almost heroic characters, you know. But looking back, you know, Hagler was just sort of a sourpuss, and Hearns was a guy who, you know, just this weird character who lost his most significant fights. Right. No one considered them kings as they do now, you know. Right. The reality is a lot different than the myth that has grown up since then.
So you talked a little about Arum, and clearly he was a central figure in this fight. Was it just that tour that he did, you know, where he had them fly around? How did he take two fighters that, as you said, weren't, you know, huge names, weren't incredibly famous, and how did he generate the kind of hype that you mentioned for this fight?
Well, he had been building Hagler slowly, not with great success. It was really a gamble. Fight after fight, he would just come back and say, I don't know what to do. You know, he thought that Hagler Duran, he thought that was going to be a big deal. But it didn't sell the way he had hoped, you know. But he just really floored it with this fight. You know, it was press, press, press. I don't think a promoter has done that since then. Maybe Don King did it, but, you know, Don King would take guys that we'd never heard of and he'd really try to build them up. But Arum, it was really just a calculated risk. And he pushed Hagler as this kind of blue collar kind of character. And he pushed Hearns as this dynamic fighter. And to their credit, they played along with it, Hagler and Hearns. they went along on this publicity tour. They hated it. They got sick of it. But you know, they did as much as you could ask of two fighters to promote the fight. And at the time, I think the press was kind of hungry for a fight because there hadn't been anything like this in a little while. You know, Hearns had fought Leonard a few years earlier. Larry Holmes had had a couple of big fights. You know, there had been the Alexis Arguello, Aaron Pryor, couple of fights, but there it had been a little while and the timing was perfect, you know, because there was sort of a dead spot in boxing that year. And, you know, and it's funny, Mike Tyson made his debut like 2 weeks before the fight, you know, just quietly in upstate New York. He had a four rounder. So there were no big names, no big fights in the horizon. And this was it.
It was kind of this little dead spot between Ali and Tyson in a way.
Yeah, and Leonard, between, you know,
Leonard. Right, Tyson. Sure.
It was just the timing of it was perfect. He put all of his chips on Hagler Hearns, and it paid off.
One of the things I found really interesting about the hype and the fight and the build up to the fight was just the whole idea of closed circuit television. As I said, I was young then. I didn't really start watching fights till a few years later. And when I did, at that point, HBO was pretty entrenched as the host of the big fights. But they went another way with this fight with the closed circuit television. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, how the closed circuit television worked and what a big part of this fight that was.
Yeah, for younger boxing fans today, I mean, you can watch a fight on your phone. You know, you can, you know, you don't have to move an inch, and you can watch a fight. But back then, you might have to drive 10 miles to get to a theater that would be showing the fight. Closed circuit television was a kind of a phenomenon that was in and out of the public's mind throughout the 50s and 60s. In the 70s, it was pretty much Ali's fights were shown on closed circuit. Some fights were televised. You could just see them at home. But the really big ones, you wanted to get people to pay money all over the country. So you'd set up your theaters in all the major cities, you know. If a fighter had a big following in New York, you'd try to get as many theaters as possible in New York that would show the fight. And then there were little fiefdoms in each area. There was, you know, one guy who booked all the theaters in New England. Another guy booked all the theaters on the West Coast. You know, it was a business, you know. But by the time of Hagler Hearns, it was starting to dip and pay-per-view where you could just watch at home. That was starting to come up, but nobody had real faith in it because you could invite 10 people to your house.
Right.
And that was cutting down on the number of tickets you could sell. You know, you'd rather have 10 people go to a theater and they all have to buy an individual ticket. And so at the time, there was sort of a little battle over whether Arum would go with pay-per-view, which was the new thing, or closed circuit television in the theaters, which was getting old. And I remember it was still a crapshoot. I remember going to theaters just hoping the connection would work, because they would have a gigantic screen in the middle of the arena. I would go to the Boston Garden, or sometimes a theater would have it. And sometimes the image would be blurry, you know, or you wouldn't get the image at all. You would just get sound, or you'd get no sound and a blurry image, you know, and you'd be sitting there kind of gritting your teeth thinking, oh man, I just paid $20 for a ticket and I'm not going to be able to see it, you know.
Right.
And there were stories of, you know, riots breaking out in theaters when you know, the images weren't good or cut. You know, sometimes the signal would die, you know.
Right.
The technology was so weird that, you know, they had to have, you know, their own private, almost like mechanics on hand, you know, to try to fix the projectors that were going to be, you know, showing this movie of the fight. It was a weird time. New fans have no idea what it was about, you know. So that was kind of why I was trying to get that in the book, to just to show them that it was a very different time. And it was only, what, 36 years ago, but drastically different. You know, I remember if a big fight was made and they said it was going to be on pay-per-view, you'd be checking the newspapers every day, hoping that it would come to your neighborhood. Because even though you had cable, mm-hmm. the pay-per-view provider may not be carrying the fight. So you right. have to go to somebody's house, you know, right. a few towns over.
I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a confusing time, really. But I was fascinated by it, and I'm glad you appreciated that chapter. I wanted to just show what it was like in 1985, you know.
Absolutely. I really appreciated that, because you really set the setting. You really showed what was going on at that time. And another example of that, I thought, was your description of Las Vegas in 1985, which was, of course, vastly different from the Vegas of today. Which, of course, Vegas ended up being the site of the fight. Could you talk a little about what Vegas was like at that point?
Well, you know, kind of like boxing, Vegas was at a midpoint and sort of a slump. It was in between the mob years and the Disney years, you know. Al Bernstein, I talked to Al Bernstein for the book. And, you know, he was saying you could still sense a little bit of the mob in there, a little bit of that old Frank Sinatra style that was sort of still in the air, but you could tell it was fading, you know, but it didn't look like anything was going to pick up the slack. You know, right. there was, you might see, Siegfried and Roy, but you also probably see mud wrestling or, you know, a lot of cheapo kind of stuff, you know. It didn't become the massive touristy attraction that it became, you know, about 10 or 15 years later. It was in a slump. People argue it was going to get out of the slump anyway. Other people say boxing was what brought it out of the slump. They certainly appreciated boxing. In fact, they started to, they made boxing part of the package. If you were booking a room, or if you were booking a vacation in Las Vegas, while you were booking it, they would tell you, you know, there's a big fight Monday night. Why don't you stay, you know, through Monday? And they would try to get visitors to stay a little bit longer. You know, they would book for the weekend, and, well, no, there's a fight Monday. You might want to see that, you know. They were using boxing to entice people to stay a little longer, maybe gamble a little bit, you know. It was a good relationship. Some people dreaded it because they thought once boxing gets in Las Vegas permanently, what's that going to do? You know, with such a big gambling presence,
right?
You know, how is that going to affect the sport? You know, and there were a lot of people who didn't want boxing to become so firmly rooted in Las Vegas. You know, in 1985, there was a big, a big movement to just ban boxing altogether. The American Medical Association was trying to stamp out boxing. And I don't think they came close, but they made a lot of noise. So that, it was an interesting time in boxing. I don't think anyone born, you know, since then who missed out on that era, I don't think they can really appreciate what the sport was going through at that time.
Right. All right, let's get to the fight.
Yeah.
One thing that was fascinating to me was you know, on the night of the fight, as you detail in the book, Hearns is in his dressing room and his legs are shot. He's got nothing in his legs. And I read that and my heart kind of broke for him, because I was like, wow, this is the fight of his life, in which he has been, you know, obviously training for and working for forever. And here he is, and he's about to go out there, and his legs are tired. Was that overtraining? Was that anxiety? Was that something else? And also, did that affect the way he fought when he got in the ring?
Yeah, it was all of the above. I think overtraining did play a part of it. There are stories that he was doing extra running at night, which was ridiculous. Like I said, it was the fight of his life, and he thought he had to put in more miles, you know. And even running on the beach when he was in Miami before he got to Las Vegas, and he was running on a beach, which is no good. He later said he was doing like 8 miles a day at one point. He said he was sneaking out to do extra running. So he had definitely overtrained. That was part of it. I think anxiety may have played into it, especially when he started thinking, wow, my legs are tired. I think the anxiety may have kicked in then, which made it even worse. And apparently, as he was making his way to the ring, about 10 minutes before the fight, he said, I just have to go out and try for the knockout. He had wanted to box. Although he kept saying, I'm going to knock him out. His plan was to box a while and then start throwing bigger punches later. But maybe 10, 15 minutes before the fight, I don't know if he said anything to Emmanuel Stewart, his trainer, or if he just said it in his own mind.
Right.
But he just decided, I got to go for the knockout. I can't stick and move for 6 rounds. You know, I just got to try to take him out. And when you had his punch, he had just knocked Duran out. Though Duran was an over the hill lightweight, not, you know, a middleweight. He had just knocked out Duran. He probably thought, I can get something done in the first round. I don't have to, you know, box a lot with this guy. But unfortunately, you know, Hagler was not giving him a chance.
No, I mean, that was, you know, anyone who's seen that fight knows, I mean, the bell rang and Hagler just charged him like a bull. And it was just free swinging from the start. And Hagler, really, that whole fight, he just kept charging and charging and charging. Why did Hagler take that approach? And how do you think that affected the fight? His strategy of just coming full speed ahead?
Well, In the book, I did interview one of the Petronelli family who was, you know, in the camp at the time. And he said that was all by design. You know, the idea was to keep coming forward to keep Hearns moving back, because the feeling was that Hearns was only effective if he was planted, if his feet were flat and he could get some leverage on the right hand. If you kept him moving backwards, he didn't have a third of the power, you know. So that was really how that strategy was created. Just keep Tommy moving backwards, keep coming forward, keep throwing, don't give him a chance to set up. And it sounds almost suicidal, because you're gambling that you're going to walk right into his right hand. Right. But if he's moving back, he doesn't have the leverage. And the other thing, and I mentioned this in the book, was that they had no concern about Hearns. I remember talking to Goody Petronelli, who was the chief trainer. And I said, were you concerned at all about Hearns? You know, that big right hand, you know. And he just laughed. He said, nah. He said, to us, he was a welterweight. That's all he was. Just a welterweight. And they thought Hagler would beat him in one round. They were that confident. which shows you how much confidence they had in Hagler. You know, they just thought, you know, Goody was funny. And I mentioned this in the book. He said, look, I know there was a lot of publicity and a lot of people love that fight, but we thought we'd beat him in one round. He was an old welterweight. That's all he was.
I mean, that first round was just, I mean, obviously the three rounds was incredible, but the first round in particular was just, I mean, it just, as you know in the book, it left people just speechless. How close did that, did that fight come close to ending in the first round? Were either of those fighters, would you say, were either of those fighters very close to a knockout in the first round?
You know, I don't think so. I think they were both on adrenaline. You know, the adrenaline was so high that I don't think they were really in danger in that first round. I think they took each other's best shots. And Hagler went back to his corner and apparently he looked at one of his trainers and said, this fight's over. You know, I took his best shot. This fight's over. You know, I think Hearns went back to his corner a little worse off because his legs were not getting any better. And his hand was already injured, you know.
Right.
So I don't think they were on the verge of going down, but they had felt what the other guy was going to bring.
That's right. For sure. And then, of course, later in the fight, Hagler developed that bad cut on his forehead, and Richard Steele took a look at him. Do you think that was was he close to calling that fight? Was that really in jeopardy?
I don't think so, because the doctor didn't seem too upset about the cut. You know, the doctor was, I don't want to say the doctor was blasé, but the doctor wasn't that concerned about the cut, because the cut was really in the middle of the forehead.
Right.
You know, it was not, you know, a real dangerous kind of cut. Occasionally it looked bad, but it was not the kind of horrifying cut that would cause a fight to be stopped. I think Richard Steele was so caught up in the action that he may have overreacted a little bit, you know. But again, a mythology grows up around the fight, you know, that, you know, they were going to stop it. And Hagler, right. You know, Hagler feared they were going to stop the fight. And I think that's a bit of a myth, a bit blown out of proportion. It was, you know, a good sized cut, but not the kind of cut that would cause a fight to be stopped.
So ultimately, of course, Hagler knocked Hearns out in the third round. What ultimately was the difference in that fight? Why do you think Hagler came out victorious in the end?
Well, part of it was his strategy was successful. He was coming forward nonstop. And the other thing was just, you know, Hearns's legs were not going to, you know, those legs were not going to hold up for, you know, and get him into the late rounds, you know, hoping Hagler would get tired. That wasn't going to happen. And I think Hearns may have overestimated his punch. I think after the Duran fight where he had knocked Duran senseless, he thought he was Superman and, you know, could just keep throwing that right hand and get himself out of trouble. I think he overestimated his power for this fight. And, you know, when you're a young guy and you've got that right hand, you know, I'd probably be the same way. You know, I'd think I'll just knock him out, you know. There were some arguments, and I put this in the book at one point. Some people thought Tommy had taken the fight a little bit lightly, that he had spent too much time having fun in Las Vegas, because apparently he was staying up late and gambling and walking around and, you know, just walking around with his entourage. But there's also a line of thinking that that's how he stayed loose, you know, rather than sit in his room worrying about the fight. He would just go out in public and, you know, try to have some fun. I think Tommy's attitude was a man goes to work 8 hours a day. At night, he should be able to loosen up. I think it was Lee Montville, one of my favorite writers, who said at that time, because he was covering the fight, he said, who is to say if Tommy, you know, stayed in every night, if the fight would have been any different, you know?
Right.
And I think also there's a saying that old fighters used to have. I think it was Jim Corbett, the old time boxer who beat John L. Sullivan in 1892. Corbett said, and I think this is very true, he said, there are nights when a fighter is better than he has ever been and better than he ever will be. And I think Hagler had that night. Hagler was not going to lose that night. He'd never fought that way before. If you watch his earlier fights, he was more of a stand-up fighter. You know, he was a stand-up fighter. He was a counter-puncher. He was kind of light on his feet. Then that night he comes out trying to be Joe Frazier, you know, coming forward, mulling the guy down, relentless. He never fought that way in the past, and he never did again. He did his fights after that. He didn't fight that way, you know. He just had it. He had it that night. That was Hagler's night.
When that fight ended, people who are watching, whether it be boxing writers, sports writers, even fans, either in attendance on closed circuit, where did people stop and say, wow, that's the best fight I've ever seen? Wow, that's an all-time great fight? Or is that something that kind of built up over the years?
Oh, well, it was what they call an instant classic. And not only among boxing fans, but among people who, you know, weren't even associated with boxing. You know, you'd be watching a hockey game and a fight would break out and the commentators would say, hey, we've got Hagler Hearns on ice. You know, it became part of the national dialogue for quite a few months. It was a big deal because there had been so much publicity. A lot of people knew about it, you know, and I don't think modern fights have that ability. As much as we all love the Tyson Fury Deontay Wilder fight, you know, was Jimmy Kimmel talking about it on his show a few nights later? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whereas all of the talk shows, David Letterman, Johnny Carson, you know, they were all talking about the fight, Hagler Hearns. They made it part of their monologues, you know. It became an instant classic, and there were debates in the paper in the days after the fight. You know, the crusty old sports writers were coming out, and they were saying, you know, they would say, I've been watching boxing since Joe Louis, and this was better than anything I've seen, you know.
Right.
That part of the myth, it's real. It's not something that grew after the fact. People love that fight immediately. And of course, there were some people who squawked saying, well, it was only three rounds. How can we, you know, how can we say it was a great fight? It was only three rounds, you know. You always get the naysayers, you know. And just like now, you're getting people who there's been a wave of people who didn't like the Wilder Fury fight. They're saying, oh, it was great, but it wasn't the right kind of great, you know. It was too sloppy to really be a great fight, you know. So even back then, you had some people saying, well, Ollie Frazier, that was great. You know, this was just three rounds, you know. And another thing that was unfortunate was that there were a lot of people who begrudged Hearns making the amount of money that he did for three rounds of work. You heard a lot of that. people saying, oh, well, I'd go in for three rounds and make $5 million, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, he came to fight. This wasn't Michael Spinks. I mean, he would, you know, he was throwing punches, and I mean, that's a little ridiculous.
Yeah, nothing, that part of boxing never changes. You always get... now they call them haters, you know, back then we just called them assholes. They always existed and they always will. But yeah, even for Hagler Hearns, there were a few people, a tiny minority of people who would say, it isn't so great. The first round was good, you know, but there were a lot of people who would, old time writers like Red Smith. He had just died. But some of the old-time writers who were still working, you know, Shirley Povich, who was an elderly man, but he was still covering sports. He was saying, you know, comparing it to some of Dempsey's fights, which, were pretty untouchable as far as excitement and legendary status. You know, he was saying, this is right up there. How can you not say it's not up there, you know? So the fight really elevated boxing. It got people, you know, interested again. And it came along at the right time because I think it whetted their appetite. So then when we started to get, you know, Tyson, and we started to get that next Olympic team, you know, which I think was, Holyfield and Pernell Whitaker and that class.
Right.
That class of 84, when they started getting bigger fights in 86, 87, I think Hagler Hearns whetted appetites and helped make that class commercially viable, you know.
Right.
It definitely set the plate, set the table.
How much of a toll did that fight take on each of the fighters, but you know, physically and psychologically, emotionally?
I think it was worse on Hagler.
Really?
Yeah. I think it was worse on Hagler. Hearns felt bad. He went back to Detroit. He got a lot of negative publicity. He felt sort of embarrassed, and he went into a little bit of seclusion for a while. But gradually he resumed his career, and he had a great career, fabulous career. Hagler, it seemed like he had blown out all of his circuits, you know, he got everything he wanted. Now he was a famous champion. All the eyes of the world were on him. That's what he'd always wanted, but he was burned out. He had left everything in the ring. with Hearns, because he came out to fight Mugabe a year later, and there were rumors that Hagler had been partying, he had started to use drugs, he was drinking a lot. There were a lot of underground gossip about Hagler, that he wasn't quite as dedicated as he had been, you know, because he got what he wanted. He was finally at the top of the mountain. And he wanted to retire, but Bob Arum said, no, you can't retire now. Now you're going to make more money than ever. We're finally where we wanted to be. So he fights Mugabe, who was, let's face it, a tough guy, but a bit inexperienced. And he was a junior middleweight. He'd never fought anyone of Hagler's caliber.
Mm-hmm.
And Hagler really had to work to beat Mugabe. And that was kind of surprising for some people. For a lot of people, it just looked like another good victory. But he looked a little extended. He was overextended by Mugabe, you know. And then he really wanted to quit. He wanted to retire. And then Leonard lured him into their fight, you know. And against Leonard, you know, Hagler looked kind of flat. You know, he was good. It was a close fight, regardless of what you think of the scorecards. It was a close fight, but to me and other people, Hagler looked flat against Leonard. And again, there were the rumors that he was partying a lot. His marriage was in trouble. He didn't have the discipline that he had had just a few years earlier. And he was a young fighter. He was only, I think, 33 or 34. He was not, you know, like Bernard Hopkins or something. You know, right. he was a young guy, but he'd already had close to 70 fights. And I think right. And his training was always tough. So I think he had burned himself out. You know, I talked to Steve Marantz for the book. Steve's all over the book. And he was a Boston Globe writer. And his opinion is that Hagler was done as soon as the Hearns fight was over.
Really?
He really had nothing left. Whatever he had left, he gave it to Hearns, both in the training and in the actual fight. So yeah, in answer to your question, I think the fight took more out of Hagler than Hearns. And there was always talk of a rematch, but it as and I give a whole chapter to that in the book too, because I had actually forgotten about that. I knew there was some talk of a rematch, but I didn't know how close it came to being made. But one thing or another kept causing it to collapse. And then finally, when Hagler lost to Leonard, you know, he retired and moved on, and Hearns was left without his rematch. But fame was a difficult thing for Hagler. And once he got it, he was almost too tired to carry it.
Let me just say once again, the name of Don's book is The War, Hearns, Hagler, and Three Rounds for the Ages. Where do you write this fight, you know, in all-time great fights, or at least all-time great fights that you've seen?
Well, I think the first round is the best round. That's easy. You know, that's an easy one. But as far as great fights, you know, There are a lot of great fights, and they all kind of elbow each other for first place. You know, they all kind of, you know, you catch me on a certain day and I'll say it was one fight, you know, catch me on another day, I'll say it was another fight.
Right.
And there are some fights that I've really liked that are not great fights. You know, that happens too. Something about them that you really loved it, you know. It might have just been because the guy you liked, he won, or he came from behind and scored a knockdown. There was a fight with Barry McGuigan. I don't know if you remember him.
No.
Barry McGuigan, and he was an Irish featherweight who was popular for a little while. And he fought this obscure California kid named Stevie Cruz. It went 15 rounds back and forth. It was a great fight. Nobody remembers it, but it was one of my favorites, you know.
Right.
It's just different days. I'll have a different answer for you, but that first round, I think it is the best round. And what's funny is that, and as I mentioned in the book, over the years, the status of that round kind of goes up and down. You know, depending on what year the survey is made,
right.
You know, it sometimes it's number one, sometimes it's number three, sometimes it gets an honorable mention, you know.
Right.
And I think because there were no knockdowns, people tend to see knockdowns and they think, oh, that was a better round because there were more knockdowns, you know.
Right.
But to my mind, I wouldn't penalize Hagler and Hearns because they stayed on their feet, you know.
Right.
I'll praise them for staying on their feet, you know. And also, it kind of depends on, like, what the latest fight is. You know, I remember when the first Ward-Gotti fight happened. Mm-hmm. Everybody loved the ninth round of that fight, you know. So in the year or so after that, whenever someone took a survey of the greatest round of all time, suddenly Ward-Gotti was up there, you know, and Hagler-Hearns was starting to dip a little bit, you know.
Right.
And part of it is just because new fans are going to vote for what happened lately.
Right.
You know, and as old fans are dying off, you know, fewer of them remember the old fights, you know.
Sure.
So that's kind of what happens. You know, it's like when ESPN did the 100 greatest athletes of all time, you know, Michael Jordan was number one because he was the most recent one. He was the one, right. He was the one that all the newer fans knew and they were going to vote for him. You know, people who weren't even born.
Right.
When, you know, when Ali or Wayne Gretzky
or Babe Ruth,
or Babe Ruth, or, you know, yeah. other athletes might have been considered, but, you know, they were a while ago, and the new thing always kind of climbs to the top. But I think anybody who watches the Hagler-Hearns fight, they'll be impressed. But the thing to do is to try to find the HBO version. Because there are actually two versions of the fight. The closed circuit telecast, which was shown in theaters.
Right.
But simultaneously, HBO was recording it to show on a replay, you know, a week later. And HBO's version, I think, is better. The camera angles are a little bit better. You see Hearns doing more. The intensity feels a little different. There are more close-ups, like it's from the waist up, the way the camera was. So you see Hagler and Hearns from the waist up, rather than what the closed circuit showed, which was far away, and you're seeing more like full body images. And again, you know, modern fans probably don't know what I'm talking about. But yeah, they had two separate versions of the fight. And to my eyes, the HBO version is more intense. You can actually see in Tommy's eyes this kind of look of concern as you know, Hagler is coming towards him, you know, and you didn't really get that from the closed circuit telecast. And I think I said the closed circuit telecast, I think I said this in the book, it was just like, you know, if you were watching it on a big screen, it just looked like two giants kind of, you know, chasing each other.
Right.
And it wasn't even boxing. It wasn't even boxing. It was something beyond boxing, you know. But on the HBO version, you really get the real taste of what was going on. And if you remember in the book, some of the people say even that didn't do it justice.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You had to be there.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause when you were there watching it, it was just like mayhem, you know? And then when you watch the replay on TV, it wasn't quite what you remembered. You know,
right.
And I can say that in my own experience, because I've covered a lot of fights. And there are moments in fights where you're convinced, you know, one of the guys is about to, you know, he's out on his feet, he's about to fall down. And there's all this drama. But then when you see it replayed on Showtime or whatever, it just kind of goes by in a second.
Right.
And it's not as intense as it was when you were there watching it. There is something very different about being in the press section. I was lucky enough to cover a lot of fights at Madison Square Garden and Foxwoods, the Boston Garden. I covered a lot of fights, and there is something about being there. Have you seen live boxing? Do you?
No, no.
There's something different about being nearby, and you're hearing the punches. You're hearing it. You know what I mean? That's weird because it sounds like a baseball bat hitting a pumpkin, you know, that's,
right.
or the body shots, you hear it, you know, that thump, 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 thump. You hear that when you're there live in the first few rows. And I guess if you're in the back row, you're just watching it on the TV screen up above the ring because you're so used to watching TV.
Right.
But if you're watching it live and you're seeing the punches connect and it's kind of sick in a way, because you can see the guy's eyes roll back in their heads, you know, and you can see the blood hitting the ring. You know, like the blood kind of falls out of their nose and splats on the ring. You hear
yeah.
that.
Wow.
It's a very different, very visceral kind of experience. So to imagine being at Hagler Hearns, your eyes can't even catch up with the action. You know, you're trying to catch up. You can't do it. And then when you watch it on TV, it's not what you saw. You know, it's a very I don't know the scientific explanation for that. I'm sure there's a word for it of what the cameras do
right.
to physical movement. But I know from my own experience, it's not the same. So I can't imagine being in Las Vegas that night. I remember Al Bernstein. I loved what Al Bernstein said when he said, you know, he was at ringside with his earphones on, the old cans that they used
right.
to wear. And he took them off so he could absorb, you know, all the electricity in the air, you know, things like that. Those little details for me, they make the book really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Don, thank you so much for coming on. As I said, I thought the book was great, and appreciate you coming on to talk about it. I have one final question for you. I'd like to ask all my guests, what is your all-time favorite sports book?
My all-time favorite sports book, other than my new one, The War.
Yes, your book's not included.
My book's not included. let me take a quick look. Actually, this one is. I'm going to hold it up.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're familiar with this one. It's a biography of Jack Dempsey.
Okay.
By Roger Kahn. Roger Kahn was primarily a baseball writer.
Right, yeah.
But I think this was from the 1990s. Roger Kahn wrote this biography of Dempsey. It's called A Flame of Pure Fire. And I love this book. And in a way, this book kind of was my guideline to write the Hagler Hearns book. Because Roger Kahn does take you back to the 1920s to write about Dempsey. And he kind of puts it all on display, the time, the atmosphere of the 20s, what boxing meant in the 20s, and what Dempsey
right.
meant. So this is one of my favorites.
It's hard to pick one.
hard to pick one, but this is, if I was going to recommend one, I'd say this one. And I also, Hugh McElvaney's collection of boxing stories, it's been published under a couple of different names. Hang on. This one was, it was called The Hardest Game. And Hugh McElvaney was a writer from the United Kingdom. He wrote for The Guardian and The Observer. He wrote for, sometimes for Sports Illustrated, the Sunday Times. He covered boxing in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s. So this one has a lot of history in it, and he's also a beautiful writer, very poetic, as they are in the United Kingdom. I don't know why that is. they're not afraid of the language, as we are in America. We don't want to sound too smart, you know what
right.
I mean?
Right, yeah.
So those are two books that I like quite a bit.
All right, I'll have to check them out.
Sure thing.
Well, thanks again, Don. Appreciate you coming on.
Absolutely. My pleasure. And tell people that they can buy my book on Amazon. And it's also being carried in some stores. Put your mask on and go out to a store and you can buy it.